This is Corolla Digital.
This Wednesday, 9 p.m., 8 Central, it's Spike TV's Guy's Choice Awards with Matthew McConaughey, Sandra Bullock, Kevin Hart, Keanu Reeves, Andy Samberg, Key & Peele, the Sports Illustrated swimsuit cover models, and more. Guy's Choice, this Wednesday, June 11th, 9 p.m., only on Spike.
You know that great idea you have? Not the Yoga for Dogs one, the other one. Yeah, the one everyone agrees is amazing. Well, it is. But now what? Look, every great idea needs a killer website. A great website is how you show, share, or sell your great ideas. Meet Weebly. Weebly.com makes it surprisingly easy to create your own high-quality site, blog, or online store. And you can even get started for free. Over 20 million people have already created their websites with Weebly. Our powerful drag-and-drop site builder makes it easy to design a unique site and bring your idea to life. And Weebly websites work brilliantly on computers, smartphones, and tablets. So whether your great idea is a business, a place to showcase your talent, or a social hub for family and friends, it's easy to start your something right now. We all know that making an idea come to life is hard, but making a website for it should be easy. Create your free website today at Weebly.com. That's W-E-E-B-L-Y, Weebly.com. Weebly.com.
Thanks to you, the Adam Carolla Show has been going strong for 5 years and continues to grow because you share it with your friends, family, and coworkers. But now, the patent troll is suing me and threatening to shut down podcasting as we know it. Please visit fundanything.com/patent troll and donate to the Podcast Legal Defense Fund today. Your donation will help defeat the patent troll and keep podcasting free. Thank you. And mahalo.
From Corolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Today, a special one-on-one with Dinesh D'Souza. And now, summer's here and the time is right for Ranting in the Streets. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. Mandate, get it on. Thank you so much for joining the program. Thanks for telling a friend. Thanks for sharing this with a friend because we count on you. Dinesh D'Souza, good to see you, my friend.
Hey, good to be on the show.
I'm a big fan of yours. I agree with, I think, everything that comes out of your mouth, except for when you're eating and you start getting passionate and a piece of broccoli comes out, then I disagree with that. But I think most of the things you say, I agree with. I certainly saw you on Mar, and I saw you a couple of weeks ago talking about Islam and so on, arguing with Arianna Huffington and things like that. And I thought, this guy's got it going on.
Yeah, you know, with Bill Maher, he's all over the place, and it's always fun for me to be on. I don't know if you know, but the last time I was on earlier, he was on Politically Incorrect.
Sure.
We were on that show right after 9/11. And
you were on the episode that he got into trouble with or on?
Yeah, and somehow for 10 years, he sort of bore a grudge because he sort of felt like I got him fired because the topic came up on that show about whether the terrorists were cowards. You remember Bush had said it, cowards.
Right.
And so he popped the question, and I said, no, I don't think they're cowards. Man, I mean, to tell some guy to fly into a wall, go to sure death, even if you think there's a bunch of virgins waiting for you, it takes a lot of guts.
Right.
So these might be really bad guys, but they're not wimps.
No, I agree with you, and I saw the episode, and I saw the episode where you returned to Mar after all those years, you know, barred from Marred, but the... And I agree with you. We do way too much of this person who called 911 as a hero and this person who flew the thing into the plane as a coward. Like, we swing really far in different directions. And I think, without putting words in your mouth, all we want is clarity, meaning these are the worst people on the planet. It's just coward doesn't quite fit the description of them.
Exactly. In other words, they're, you know, evil people aren't necessarily cowards.
You wouldn't call the pilots, the Japanese pilots that flew the planes into the aircraft carriers at the end of World War II, the kamikaze pilots. You wouldn't call them cowards.
Exactly. So part of it is, and particularly after 9/11, there was so much confusion about trying to understand who's behind all this. And as you know, ever since then, there's been a whole effort to detach the motives of these terrorists from the religion they practice, namely Islam.
Right.
And that was the point of agreement between Bill and me on the recent show, is we're like, listen, they saw themselves as being pious Muslims. Now, you can say not all Muslims think that way, but it's certainly true that a great motive for contemporary terrorism is radical Islam.
But here's what I don't understand about the left in general, and the right is guilty of it to some degree, but I feel like the left does a ton of this, where you say, we have a problem. And that problem could be anything from the inner cities and the kids and the graduation rates to the Islam and terrorists and whatever it is. And basically what you're saying is this house is infested with termites. And they're saying, not every wall in this house has termites. And you say, yeah, I know, but there is a problem. And they're saying, not every stud in this house has termites. So you can't, and you're going, yes, not every inner city child is not graduating high school. Not every Muslim is a, but there's a higher percentage, and thus it needs to be focused on and addressed. You keep saying not every, I mean, when Arianna Huffington looked at you and said, what he is saying is that every terrorist, every Muslim is a terrorist. And you said, no, that's not what I said. I didn't. How could we ever begin to address the problem when the dentist says you have two cavities and you go, well, I have 26 teeth that don't have cavities. Not every tooth has a cavity. What, don't you just want to focus on the cavity and see for you if we can fix the tooth?
You know, I think some of this got started, if I'm going to be honest about it, during the civil rights movement. And the reason I say that is there was a great campaign against stereotypes.
Sure.
Now, what's a stereotype but a generalization? Now, in the past, there were people who had very nasty generalizations about groups. But the way to fight them was to show that they're false or that they're being wrongly applied. What really happened is there became a prejudice in our culture against generalizing.
Yes.
And so, you know, literally you'd say things like, you know, men are taller than women. And people say, well, that's a stereotype.
Not all. There's a lot of women in WNBA.
Right.
Who are taller. There's a lady who plays the center for the Los Angeles Sparks who's taller than
my neighbor
than
Fred,
Danny
who's
4'8". DeVito. Yeah, okay, understood. But now can we get back to the truth for a second?
Exactly. And this is relevant because it's not just a matter of talking sense. I mean, entire industries like insurance are based upon making intelligent generalizations. For example, young men are a lot more likely to bash their cars than young women.
Right.
And that's why insurance rates are different. It's not it is discrimination, I suppose, but it's legitimate discrimination based on behavior.
Right. It's you set up a pattern and we'll set up a pattern economically that follows that because we're business. Now, if they were a government appointed enterprise, if they were school system or something else, well, they probably wouldn't favor males, but I'm saying you couldn't do the reverse. By the way, I'm not even sure Allstate could do the reverse. If more women got into more accidents, it'd be an interesting experiment. Right now, young teenage boys have a disproportionate amount of car accidents as it pertains to women. So they have to pay a higher rate.
Right.
It's just, that's the open market. That makes sense. We all understand that. Now you can go, you're discriminating against. No, it's market value. It's just fair market value. That's what they're costing us because they get into car accidents three times at the rate that women do. I wonder if women, if they reversed the circumstances and women got into it three times as much as men, if we then said, well, now women, you're going to have to pay a higher rate, I wonder if there'd be an outcry, because I bet there would.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I mean, certainly when it comes to disease, therefore, take, for example, breast cancer. Now, men can get breast cancer, but they're much less likely to get it than women.
Sure.
And so if you had, it'd be interesting to see if you had insurance in the industry only for that disease, how they would treat it.
Right. And what you and I and what Dinesh's book, which is out, is We Speak, America, Imagine a World Without Her. I saw the documentary. I actually watched it twice over the weekend and loved it. We're going to get into that in a second. It's available on Amazon, by the way. The book is available on Amazon right now. And you know what to do. You bookmark it at AdamCarolla.com and you click through and you put a little wind in the sails of our pirate ship here. But what Dinesh is basically saying in the documentary and in the book is capitalism, it may not be the best, it's sort of the only. In my view, it's really the only thing that motivates people and keeps them in line. There's not enough cops, there's not a big enough government, there's just not enough. It's just, you get paid more if you do a better job, you get paid less when you do a crappy job, and it gets you out of bed Monday morning.
Yeah, you know, Marx had this idea that people should work in the morning and then do criticism in the afternoon and then sleep in the evening. But he had no idea how to organize an economy, how to motivate people. Communism, I think, does work, but it works only in the family, right? And the family is based upon from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. But no society is based upon that. And I think even Obama knows that. So that what's going on now is that capitalism is the undisputed system for every economy, but it's under this fierce moral critique by people who want the government to play quarterback in our economy.
To me, it's so weird that people would even question capitalism and motivation, meaning every guy I went to high school with, I always say, look, payday is Friday. And it's not Friday morning. It's Friday afternoon at the end of work. Whenever I work construction, you got your check at 3:35 on Friday because that was it. If you got paid on Monday at noon, those guys wouldn't have showed up on Tuesday. I mean, that's who I worked with. That's what motivated those guys. Unfortunately, it's what motivates three quarters of the planet. That paycheck comes Friday afternoon. The folks that sit around and pontificate and say, but wouldn't it be better if we trusted the workers and that we could pay them Monday morning? And I go, it would be. And that would be nice. Except for guess what? They're not showing up. So let's just do it Friday and move on to the next topic. Why don't we understand that?
You know, I think we don't understand it, or at least a lot of people don't understand it, because they'll look at a job and they try to put an intrinsic value on it. Obama, for example, what part of his speech rhetoric, he likes to say stuff like, you know, in China they pay teachers as much as doctors. And he wants applause when he says that.
Right.
Why? Because he's basically thinking a teacher is really important and a doctor is really important, so both should be paid kind of the same because they're both equally essential. But in a market economy, it's not like that. You take a guy like Matt Damon, right, with his karate moves and the Bourne identity. Now, that stuff is, I'm not saying it doesn't take some skills, but it may last 6 weeks and he gets $10 million.
Right.
Now, if you ask me intrinsically, I can't possibly think of what kind of workout would justify $10 million for 6 weeks, but I'm not deciding. The people who decide are all the guys who go and buy a ticket to the guy's movie.
Sure.
And so they're putting money in his pocket, and that's what's creating inequality. So if you sit around and try to decide what's the intrinsic value of it, you can't. The intrinsic value is decided by the consumer.
You know, I sort of look at it as a sort of a pyramid, and it's something that I will say to my kids. They just turned 8, my twins, but how many people can do your job? And if you flip burgers at McDonald's like I used to do, then the answer is everyone who's ever been born and some that were stillborn can actually replace you. So what are you worth? $4 an hour, $7 an hour, whatever the minimum wage is what you're worth. And by the way, if there wasn't a minimum wage, you may not even get that because everybody on the planet can do your job. And then as you work your way up to manager and owner of a franchise and whatever it is, there's less and less people. Now, by the time you become the NFL quarterback who threw the winning touchdown, now there's you and 9 other guys on that brick at the top of the pyramid, and thus you're going to get $15 million a year. It's a pretty simple right on up. The fewer there are of people who can do what you can do, the more you get paid.
That's very good. I mean, I think because you've worked these different jobs, you've seen them from the inside out. Adam Smith once gave the example of who makes a pin, and he talked about a factory in which there are 12 different guys, each doing different tasks. Now, he says it's a great illusion for the guy who puts the head on. He thinks, I made the pin.
Right.
He doesn't realize all the things behind him that have enabled this to happen. So I think what happens in our society is it inequality generates envy. And people think, what the hell? I can do what that guy's doing. Yeah, but you're not doing it.
You know what I think is going on to a large extent in our new-ish society, the one that seems to have cropped up, sucks because I was poor my entire life, and I always thought, wouldn't it be great to have money? And now that I have money, it sucks to have money in the sense that nobody looks up to you anymore. You're now the enemy. It's people wanting to know when you're going to pay your fair share and all that shit. And don't get me wrong, people who are listening, I'd rather have money than not have money. And you shouldn't feel sorry for me or weep a tear for me. But what I'm saying is I didn't know that when I started paying the bills and paying the taxes and taking care of business, that society would crop up, look at me as the one percenter, and make me the enemy.
Yeah, now this is something I think that is kind of new.
Oh, it's definitely
it's very new.
It's very new.
Because look, you look at the federal government's income tax revenues. Now, the top 1%. You mentioned the 1%. The top 1% pays 33% of all the federal taxes in America. 33%. The next 9% pays the next 33%. So two-thirds of all the federal tax revenues are coming from 10% of the earning population. The bottom 50% of America pays nothing. Nothing.
Right.
So, you know, our revolution was no taxation without representation. But weirdly, we live in a society where half the population has representation without taxation.
Well, we'll play a few clips from the movie. The fair share thing crops up, which makes me want to take a cucumber peeler and just peel every ounce of my skin off when I hear that people point at folks and go, when are you going to start paying your fair share? And the answer is, First off, do you really want to explore fair and share? Because I'll tell you what, whoever Obama or Diane Warren, whoever, or
Elizabeth Warren,
Diane Warren writes songs. Elizabeth Warren, I'll tell you what, I would love to pay my fair share. Let's sit down and figure out what my share is. And
right.
Then when we pencil out my fair share, I'm going to save so much goddamn money.
Well, you know, the funny thing, Warren has this big speech where she goes, you know, you moved your goods to market on roads. The rest of us, you mean that guy's not paying for the roads? He's paying for the roads, too. It's not the rest of you. Everybody pays and everybody uses the roads.
We're going to hear that in 1 second. First, DraftKings, because I got to pay some bills. My listeners winning like crazy. Crazy money, DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-day fantasy baseball site. Do not miss this. One guy turned $11 into $4,000. Another guy, well, then after taxes. Another guy won $100,000, first time ever. Someone last year won $1,000,000. It is easy. It's one-day fantasy baseball. No season-long commitments. No being stuck with players. Just instant cash every day. DraftKings, Dawson.
Right now, get free entry into DraftKings' biggest fantasy baseball contest of the year. Over $3,000,000 in cash prizes with $1,000,000 for first place. Enter Adam at DraftKings.com for your free shot at hundreds, thousands, even $1,000,000. Free spots are going quick. Enter Adam now at DraftKings.com. DraftKings.com.
Now, I first sort of caught on to Elizabeth Warren when she was talking about, she was here to explain that the system was rigged and that the field wasn't level. And I said, I hate that message. I hate it. I hate for any official or school teacher or coach or anybody in a capacity to tell its team, students, constituency, it's rigged against you. Because what that saying is don't get out of bed. Why bother? Would you play a chess game that was rigged against you? Would you go to a casino and sit down at a blackjack table if you knew it was rigged against you? And I know the casino has a mathematical advantage, but I mean rigged against you. No, you'd never even sit down.
Yeah, exactly. I see. This is so to put my finger on what has changed in our country. You can almost think of American society as kind of a bandwagon with a few guys sitting in the wagon, and those are the guys. Let's go back to the New Deal, right? There's always been some guys who can't take care of themselves, and the rest of the population is pulling the bandwagon. It's true that since the 1930s through the 60s to now, more and more people are in the bandwagon. So initially It was maybe 3 guys out of 100. Now it's about 20 guys.
Right.
But that's not even what's really changed. What's really changed is you might expect our leaders to go to the guys who are pulling and say, listen, guys, we're in a tough economy. You know, we really appreciate you. You're the best people in America. Thank you for doing what you're doing because you're enabling these other guys to ride along while you pull. Instead, What Obama does, he goes to the people in the bandwagon. He goes, you are the most morally wonderful people in America. And then he goes to the guys who are pulling and he goes, you're greedy, you're selfish, you're materialistic, you better pull harder. So what's he doing? Demoralizing the productive people in our economy and giving you the idea, which, sure, then you get the idea, well, maybe I should be riding in the bandwagon. Life's a little more pleasant over there.
I was trying to think about this as I was watching your documentary, and I was thinking about the fact of, I have said, look, I don't like all the bullying talk. And people are like, you're for bullying? And I'm like, no, I'm not for bullying. I'm just tired of turning everyone into a victim of bullying. And then I realized that's what I don't like about it. I don't like everybody being a victim. I don't like it, not for me, I don't like it for them. I don't want, like, you ask me, was I bullied? I guess. I don't know. I never thought about it. I didn't think of it as being bullied. I thought of it as junior high and high school. I thought of it as people you get along with and some people you don't get along with. I thought it was, yeah, you have weird hair, then you're called Brillo head. I understood it. And you wear glasses, you were called Four Eyes. Like, understood, but I never looked at it, and no one ever looked at it as being bullied. Even people got into fights and fist fights. It's still, I got into a fight, but it wasn't, I'm being victimized. And I hate that idea that somehow our elected officials are there to convince everybody that they're being victimized, or at least the lion's share of the people that voted for them, that they're getting screwed. They're going to continue being screwed. And by the way, they're the ones who are going to unscrew them or protect them from getting screwed, except for magically, that never happens. I even hated the hope and change thing. I didn't like, first off, we're Americans. We don't hope for shit. We go do stuff. We don't, hoping is buying a lottery ticket and sitting home and praying and rubbing your rosary beads. We don't hope for anything. And change, how much change do we need to do?
The other thing is, you know, this is the old American spirit, which is when things turn against you, which sometimes happens. And in fairness, capitalism, there was an economist, Schumpeter, who called it a gale of creative destruction, meaning industries are turned topsy-turvy. Mm-hmm. At one time, 70% of Americans worked on farms. And then as technology got better, and now look at one guy with headphones and a tractor, and he's farming 500 acres. So you don't need all these guys on the farm. So what's the solution? Get your butt off the farm. You got to go do something else. It's not easy because you've been doing it for generations and your way of life is gone and all that. But all those Americans realize that they just can't stay on the farm. And the government can't just keep farming going because once there's enough food for people to eat, then there are other things to be done. So something like that has happened in some of our manufacturing sectors. There are things in America that are now done by technology, by robots, or by foreigners, a lot cheaper. And so there needs to be change. We're moving into a more knowledge economy. It's not easy. But our problem is that our politics isn't tough and can't say to people, look, there's no alternative but to learn into doing something new. The government can help you learn, but we're not going to protect your job because you're making something that can be made for half the price somewhere else.
I want to hear about your personal background and when you came to this country and just how you became who you were. But first, from Dinesh's new, and 2016, by the way, was the last doc, which was absolutely, in terms of political documentaries, I think the second biggest one ever. Unbelievably, $33 million-plus at the box office. Oh, what a country, as Yakov Smirnoff used to say. America, imagine a world without her. And I'm passionate about this documentary because, just so people know exactly where I am with this, I'm not a flag-waving, sort of blind, rah-rah guy who says we have never hurt anyone, killed anyone, that there's not problems, that there's not issues, that we haven't had issues in the past, and we don't have issues today, and we won't have issues tomorrow. I've never said that. All I've said was, can we stop beating ourselves up? What model for a country that doesn't exist are we using that is so much more philanthropic and so much better and so much everything than us? I look at all these other regimes around the world throughout history and I say, look, we're the best. And we have faults, but we're the best. And as you say, you know, when we're done whipping the shit out of Germany and we're done with Japan, we helped them rebuild and we left. We didn't, I don't know who else would have done that. As a matter of fact, those wars were started to take over Poland and take over Russia and take over whoever you're going to, China and whoever you're going to annex. We're the only ones who put people back together. And then we never stop beating ourselves up about the atomic bomb, which saved hundreds of thousands of lives. We just never stop beating ourselves up. And all I'm saying is, can we just give ourselves a break from beating ourselves up? We are a force for good in the world. We've done bad. But that doesn't mean we're not a force for good, and I'll tell you why. You know we're good. Every time there's a tsunami, everyone just looks at our country and goes, what are you going to do?
And if we were to take our borders down, there'd be a big rush.
Right. People are going, look, it's pretty simple. When you take Berlin and you put a wall down the middle of it, and you just, a couple of Martians from outer space, and you go, what's going on the east side? Well, people are getting killed trying to get to the west side. Well, the people on the west side obviously are doing something and have created a better society, a better government, a better way of living.
I think this, what you're talking about now is really my life story, because I grew up in India. And I grew up, you know, I grew up middle class, but in India, middle class means something totally different than here.
What does it mean?
Well, it basically means you grew up without hot water and you grew up without a phone. And we had a car, but actually, if I looked at the ground, I could see the street. I didn't miss any meals. I have no complaints, and I got a good education. But point I want to make is when I came to America, I was stunned by the abundance of the ordinary guy.
How old were you when you came to America?
I was 17. I came as a student.
So what you're saying is, I know, this is one of the only countries where you can be poor and have three TV sets.
Exactly. Or you can be poor and 300 pounds,
right?
For that matter.
Sure.
The Indian poor are like emaciated. They look like their bones are about to fall off.
Right.
And so I said, you know, every country looks after the rich guy. In India, you got super rich guys, and they all live fantastically at a level you can't even imagine. But a country is sort of judged by what kind of life it gives to the ordinary guy, and maybe even the guy who's not that hardworking and not that smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice a guy who's not that hardworking and not that smart in America has two cars and a nice garage, and if he lives in California, sometimes a little pool in the backyard, and he's got indoor plumbing and central heat. And I thought, wow, this country is making it pretty nice for its ordinary citizens.
I want to hear the rest of your story in a second. I want to hear this Elizabeth Warren thing that always makes me want to yak first, just because we're talking about it. It's from Dinesh's new doc, which is out on July 4th.
July 2nd. It goes 2nd. Nationwide.
July 2nd, sorry.
And it's only right that we ask everyone to pay their fair share.
Asking everyone to pay their fair share. Pay their fair share.
There is nobody in this country
who got
rich on his own. Nobody. You built a factory out there. Good for you. But I want to be clear.
By the way, stop it for a second. First off, it's like, thank you for letting me build a factory, your cuntness. Like, she has disdain for the people that built something? Like, she's fine. I'll let you have your stinking factory with your 500 employees and your huge tax base. Okay, so, all right, I'm in a good mood. I'll let you have a factory. Thank you, Your Highness. Thank you for letting me build a factory. I just love the idea. It's like, fine, you got your stinking factory with your jobs.
Can you imagine, you know, my daughter's in the studio, just finished her freshman year in college. Imagine if I say here, you know, young lady, you know, you got some good grades on the SAT, fine, but you drove to take the test on the roads that the rest of us use.
Right.
You don't deserve credit for your SAT scores because you took roads. She'd think I was nuts.
We'll listen to the rest of her tirade. It sounds insane.
Nobody in this country who got rich on his own. Nobody. You built a factory out there. Good for you. But I want to be clear. You moved your goods to market on the roads the rest of us paid for.
Yep.
You hired workers the rest of us paid to educate. You were safe in your factory. because of police forces and fire forces that the rest of us paid for.
Oh, my God. I mean, first off, forget about whatever you feel toward her. Can you imagine, and by the way, I always just say stupid or liar. I'm assuming she's just a liar and telling the people who are listening to her who don't own factories what they want to hear. I don't imagine she's that stupid because she's an educated woman. But could you imagine, just forget about politics, just from a pure logic-based standpoint, if this person was running your Fortune 500 company? Like, I don't even know what is the logic that she's using? I don't even know what she's saying. It's pure rhetoric. She's talking to people that she thinks are dumb, and she's telling them what they want to hear. But what is she saying?
Well, what she's saying at the first glance seems kind of self-evident, and I wouldn't disagree with it, that, look, there is an infrastructure in any society, and that infrastructure is necessary for us to do what we do, right? In other words, obviously you and I couldn't be doing this podcast if we didn't have air to breathe.
Right.
So there's a necessary infrastructure, but after stating that self-evident fact, you really realize what she's up to is something a little different. She's not saying, hey, listen, if a great teacher taught you, go back and thank her. Or you might want to give her a little bonus because, after all, she taught you those math skills and today you're a software genius. No,
right.
She's not. What she's doing is she's trying to detach effort from reward.
Right.
She's trying to say wealth is not created by Adam Carolla or Steve Jobs. Wealth is kind of created by all of us collectively. Society creates wealth.
And thus, give some of it back.
Right.
A lot of it back.
That the greedy entrepreneur is sort of stealing it. And therefore, society has a right to kind of pick your pocket because they're only taking back the stuff that belongs to everybody that you are in possession of.
Well, also, this notion, which just took flight very recently in this country, that wealth and prosperity is some sort of mason jar of M&Ms, and that Steve Jobs reached in and grabbed a whole bunch and took all the ones away that my parents were going to grab, or my kids were looking to grab, or that I was going to grab, or that the guy drives the tractor or the backhoe or works at the post office. It's somehow this notion that these guys, that there's this finite amount of M&Ms and that somebody's hoarding. These fat cats are hoarding. And now there's not enough left for the hardworking people who, you know, drive the school buses and teach your kids and are cops or firemen. And it's, no, it's not that. Steve Jobs created something that a bunch of people wanted and added more M&Ms to this jar or got 10 more jars.
You're now touching on a really important point. When I was a kid in high school in India, I'd go to school with a pocket full of marbles. And none of us had any money. And so I realized that the only way for me to get more marbles is to get somebody else's marbles. Because the number of marbles was finite.
Right.
Right? And in the old world, wealth was like that. Wealth was in land. And if you got more, somebody else was going to have less.
Right.
I think the beauty of our productive, innovative economy is here comes Steve Jobs. And what's interesting is there's no demand for his product. No one even knew they wanted it. He made it first.
Right.
Right? He created the demand. He came up with something that you and I didn't even know we wanted or needed. But once he offered it, we're like, hey, that's cool. We'd like to get one. And the highest entrepreneurial rewards go to entrepreneurs like that. In other words, they're not just supplying the food that people demand. They're creating new needs and new wants.
Right.
And in a sense, multiplying the possibilities available to life in America.
All right. Now, don't let me forget, because I can just go all day with you. Don't let me forget to get to your background. What guys want. Guys' Choice Awards this Wednesday. Only one place where the biggest names in entertainment gather for all things guy. Spike TV, Guys' Choice Awards. This Wednesday, 9 p.m., Kevin Hart's getting the Mantlers Award. Long overdue, if you ask this broadcaster. Matt McConaughey is going to get an award. Sandra Bullock and Johnny Knoxville and appearances by Keanu Reeves and Mark Wahlberg and the Sports Illustrated swimsuit models and Key and Peele and Cameron Diaz and Jessica Alba and Jason Segel. Let's not confuse the two. Olivia Munn. I just think I made one of the funniest and best looking comedic actors of all time, Jessica Segel. Grab Life by the Mantlers. Guy's Choice, this Wednesday, June 11th, 9 p.m., only on Spike. So much more to get into, but your background. So you grow up middle class, but that's poor. Middle class for, I mean, what you have in India is, when you say poverty, you have, you know, slumdog millionaire poverty, like real poverty.
Exactly. And much of the world is like that. But I think when I came to America, I remember seeing it for the first time, seeing the Statue of Liberty, seeing New York City. I think what occurred to me wasn't just that I was in a place of abundance, but also I was in a place of possibilities, that there are things you can do with your life here, well, just like what you and I do, that if I went to my father or my grandfather and said, I want to do a podcast, or I want to be a comedian, or I want to make films, I mean, he would have my head examined. So America offers you a way to be the architect of your own destiny or write the script of your own life in a way that I don't think any other country does even today.
Right. Now, look, and I've said it to everybody. Well, it's always insane. Somebody just sent me a tweet, and it was Morgan Freeman, and he was talking to, being interviewed by, I'll get his name in a second, but CNN. There's a black newscaster on CNN. And he's talking to him about, you know, racism, and what do you think about racism, and what do you think about the disparity between, and how can you overcome, and blah, blah, blah. And Morgan Freeman said, no. And the guy went like, what? And he went, well, we're here, aren't we? I mean, you're a broadcaster, and I'm a celebrity, and here we are. Like, whoa, what are we talking about? And the idea that we can talk about it, you know, that Oprah Winfrey can be a female and be black and be the richest person in our country, and yet we can still talk about how we're never-ending struggle and holding down the women and holding down African-Americans and all kinds of stuff. It just seems almost insane to me that we never stop that discussion.
Right. And part of the mystery I try to unravel in this book, America, and to some degree in the film as well, is why is this going on? I call it the shaming of America.
Yes.
Because all this started independently, right? We took the country from the Indians, and there were Native Americans saying that. And then we stole the labor of the African Americans. That was another thing. And then we took half of Mexico in the Mexican War. And what's really interesting is someone sat down at some point and brought all these shaming narratives together.
Yes.
And it basically became, I call it America the Inexcusable. We suck. We're the worst country in the world.
Right.
Now, I'm an immigrant, and I'm like laughing my head off because I'm thinking, compared to what? You know?
Yes. Compared to what? And that, you know, in the documentary, one thing that I thought was really eye-opening to me, which was, you have one Indian tribe, and they're going, that's our land. That's our land. That's our sacred land. Yeah, but you stole it from another tribe, and they stole it from two other tribes. So who's...
Right.
You guys did the exact same thing we did.
Right.
And so you bring up India, you bring up the UK, all the different... all the different folks that rolled through there historically.
You know, we were interviewing somebody, actually it was a Native American activist for the film, and I left this out of the movie because I didn't actually want to make this person look bad. But I kept saying, I said, look, there were all these peaceful tribes, the Hopi, the Pueblo, and so on. And then there were all the rather tough tribes, like the Arapaho and the Navajo. And so the strong tribes conquered the weak tribes. So when the white man got here, pretty much every Indian tribe occupying land had gotten it from some other tribe.
Right.
And this person goes, actually, no, we have been here since the time of the dinosaurs. And I had to pause. I'm like, are you actually saying the dinosaurs? Absolutely, yes, since the time of the dinosaurs. I said, let's leave it out of the movie. It's just too much to take.
Is that the guy was smoking?
People didn't grow out of the ground at the time of the dinosaurs.
Right. So when you look at all this, you know, we enslaved the people and we raped the land and all, you know, all this. Again, we're in the Middle East for the oil. Really? $5 a gallon out here for premium in California. Why aren't we taking over? But look, I'm all for taking the oil. But why aren't we doing it? Like this notion of like, oh, let's please, that's a fight over there for oil. Like, okay.
I wish it were.
I wish it were, too. All right,
yeah.
Let me just play a clip that I particularly liked, which was Madam Walker. And I'll tie it into my kid's eighth birthday and something I sort of learned. This is a little bit longer, but this is something you never read about in the history books. I never heard about it. Dinesh brought it up in his in his doc, and I thought it was really interesting. So go ahead.
Meet Sarah Breedlove, also known as Madam C.J. Walker. She started selling her own hair care products door-to-door.
Now, what year is this?
So this would be in the early part of the 20th century, between 1900 and about 1910.
Now, here's a
Madam C.J. Walker became the first self-made female millionaire in America.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning, ladies. I'm back to work.
So she's started a factory, but this is a speech I like here.
But only by your vision of who you can become. Today you see a success. And I hear many of you say, but Madam Walker, I just don't have the opportunities you have. And I respond, really? I was the first freeborn in my family. Orphaned at age 7. Married at 14 and widowed with child by 20. I'm a woman that came from the cotton fields of the South. From there, I was promoted to the washtub. From there, I was promoted to the cook kitchen. From there, I promoted myself to the business of manufacturing hair goods and preparations. I have built my own factory on my own ground. I got my start by giving myself a start. Ladies, there is no flower-strewn path to success. And if there is, I haven't found it. If I've accomplished anything in my life, it's because I was willing to work hard.
What a role model. So why is she left out of the history books? Because she confounds the shame narrative. She's an African-American success story.
Right, we got it. And I had...
You can't have it. Right, this was during segregation. This is in the height of segregation. A woman who's an entrepreneurial success. And so our history books are telling a morality tale. It's a morality tale of American oppression. And any stories that don't fit have got to be very delicately treated or left out altogether.
It's an interesting thing. It's what we call a first world problem. But I had this moment, which was I was celebrating with my twins, and I took them out for their birthday was yesterday, and I took them. Oh, hold on, let me pass something on to somebody. Yeah, they're looking for that Morgan Freeman thing. I don't know. You having trouble, Gary? Yeah, you got. No, I know, but you have the right in. It's a favorite tweet, but anyway, you can look it up. So I took my wife and kids out for their birthday, for their 8th birthday. And we got, you know, hey, it's your birthday, and we got the desserts. You know, they brought the cake and stuff like that. And my son just had a bowl of whipped cream because he eats like a puss. He really does. He's weird. He likes carrots and celery and stuff like that, but then there's other things that's just off limits to him. So he's simply just eating this whipped cream. And I go and I grab, I know he likes fruit, I grab a spoonful of the strawberry with the raspberry, little compote, got some of the syrup and the juice on it, and I just sort of dump it on top of his little bowl of whipped cream. And I go, there you go. You got some fruit and some whipped cream, so I don't have to just sit there and watch him literally just eat lard in front of me, you know. And he picks out a strawberry, and he eats a strawberry, and then he says, Dad, you got the syrup, the red syrup on my whipped cream, and you ruined my whipped cream. And I said, it's fine. It's whipped cream that now tastes like strawberry. You just ate a strawberry. You like strawberries. And he went, but Dad, and then my wife chimed in, and she said, Dad, why'd you do that? And I said, I had a really weird visceral reaction to it, maybe a little too strong. I was like, quiet. And she was like, you ruined his whipped cream. And I said, don't say that. Don't say it in front of him. Don't say it in front of him. And then the next thing you know, he was like, yeah, it's ruined. And then my daughter jumps in on the bandwagon. Look at it. It's ruined. And I said, it's not ruined. It's fine. It's fine. Mommy, be quiet. Don't start feeding him stuff. What you should be saying is, don't worry about it. It's fine. Move on. Eat around it or eat it up. Whatever it is, let's not all. And the whole table turned on me. They'd all made a mountain out of a molehill of whipped cream. But the point is the second my wife jumped in and said, what did you do to him? Everyone else turned on me and he turned on me and they all realized and said, oh, now I can't eat what's in front of me. And I realized the narrative of you're not up to this. You've been enslaved. You've been challenged. You can't go forth. You can't be prosperous. You can't. It's a horrible narrative.
Horrible.
Don't say it. Admit that it. Address it. Yes, it happened. Yes, this went on. Now, let's move forward. Let's
you
go.
Know, when I came to America and I went to college here, and then I was thinking of becoming an American citizen. And I was scared of it because the immigrant is a bit like a man on a tightrope. And you're walking between two tall buildings. So the first building is India and the next building is America. Now, at some point, as you walk out on the tightrope, you've left India. Mm-hmm. You're far enough away that you don't feel Indian, but you're not America either. You're in between. You're the man in the middle. It's really precarious. And there's an impulse that wants you to run back, right? Mm-hmm. Now, but if you're going to become an American, you can't do that. You got to fight that and you got to move ahead. But what happens on the college campus today is what's called multiculturalism. And multiculturalism is, no, Dinesh, you don't actually need to keep going. You can actually have India and America. In fact, you can have India in America. So you don't actually need to make this brave choice of continuing to walk on the tightrope and embrace America and assimilate to the American way of life and become American.
Right.
And so that's my point, is this is already a terrifying thing to do. It requires courage. And multiculturalism tells people you don't have to do it.
Again, whether it's you don't need to learn to speak English because you speak Spanish and this was your land and you live in Texas and your forefathers own that land, and so why should you speak English? You're not helping anybody who you're attempting to help by talking them into not talking.
Right. You can get by with Spanish if you live in Miami, but if you want to live anywhere else, you kind of need to know some English.
It'd be nice. And I'm not saying it because I hate you or I hate your culture. I'm saying it because I love you and I want you to get further along.
Believe
that's
me,
the part that's
the immigrants,
tough.
The immigrants know this. The people who are corrupting the immigrants are the leftists in this country. The immigrants aren't the problem. If you left the immigrants to their own, they'd all be learning English.
Sure.
That's why they come here. I mean, they're coming. The immigrant, I once told a professor of mine, you keep telling me about cultural relativism. All cultures are basically equal. I go, actually, if all cultures are basically equal, I would never have left home. Because it's much easier to hang around with your own family and your own pals and the world you grew up in. But the reason the immigrant picks up and leaves all that behind is they're voting with their feet in the most decisive way possible against their own culture and in favor of another culture because they think it's better.
I've been saying that for a long time. That's all this country was and is. It's sadly turning into a bunch of little islands of culture in an island chain when it used to just be one big island with all the sort of cultures on it. And by the way, you're always going to have a Latin culture, an Italian culture, and a black culture. You're always going to have that. Why the big separations now? That is not going to serve anybody. And it's certainly not, it's not going to serve the culture that's separating either.
And the latest version of this is now the gay rights, right? We had the minority rights, we had the women's rights. And the problem is, I believe we're all in this country a minority of one. We're individuals and we have rights as individuals. End of story. We don't actually need group rights because our rights accrue to us as individuals.
Bono, who I normally like to harp on, was actually quite eloquent about that in a segment of the doc. We got Morgan Freeman's little CNN. I think it was Don Lemon. I think he was speaking to. I'm pretty sure it was
didn't
him.
Didn't look like him to me, but it could be. I've been
all black people look the same to you, Gary?
It is, Don. They do all look the same to me. I'm very sorry.
How come when I say it is the guy, you give the look of,
I didn't recognize him, but I'm being
told
that
how does the guy not
wrong.
Look like the guy?
I'm being told I'm wrong. I'm sorry. I'm
yes.
trying to
Yes, you're being told twice that you're wrong.
My mistake.
Here question is, why's first impulse to go, Charles Nelson Reilly? That doesn't look like Charles Nelson Reilly. Except for it is Charles Nelson Reilly.
Well, you said Don Rickles, so what am I supposed to think?
Oh, I did? Anyway, yeah, we got the clip.
So
I'll tell you what.
Go back to,
where were we? Oh, now hold for 1 second. Let's take a very quick break, and we'll come back with Dinesh D'Souza. America, Imagine a World Without Her, great documentary coming out July 2nd. The book, same title, out as we speak. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, everybody. This is Pat O'Brien. Either your grandfather, your father, or you grew up with me doing sports for the last 30 years, plus all the entertainment and pop culture things that I did, all those red carpets for you out there. Now, we're putting all that in a podcast, The Pat O'Brien Show. Go to iTunes and find it. Go to thepatobrienshow.com. We're here. We work for you on The Pat O'Brien Show. Thanks.
Go to meeting, baby. Good communications. Crucial for any business. You need to stay connected. You want to meet coworkers, clients, wherever they are. It doesn't matter. Traveling all over Timbuktu. Remember people used to say that? Walla Walla, Washington. Peoria. That's all the stuff from the cartoon. GoToMeeting. Brought to you by Citrix. The proven solution for meeting and collaborating online. You can share the same screen. You can review documents, presentations in real time. Use the built-in HD video conferencing. Works like a charm. Just need a webcam. See each other face-to-face. It's effective. We use it here all the time. We use it when we talk to new clients. Start hosting your own face-to-face online meetings today. Do it from your Mac, your PC, tablet, smartphone. See why millions choose GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting, and you can try it free, 30 days free. Visit GoToMeeting.com. Do it today. Try it free. You click on the try it free button. Use the promo code Adam. So let's review. GoToMeeting.com, promo code Adam. Box.com. Oh, going to Costco or Sam's Club's frustrating. I mean, you get the discounts. You get all the stuff, but you got to wait in line, parking, and the carts banging into you. Those days are gone, baby. Boxed.com. Do all your wholesale shopping on your mobile device. No membership fees. Free shipping for orders over $60 and hundreds of products similar to the Costco and Sam's Club. Easy. They took all the good stuff about the big box places and eliminated the crappy part. The standing in line, the parking lots, the forever, the killing a Saturday. Box.com. Enter the promo code Adam at checkout. Get 15% off your first order. Save time, gas, membership fees with Boxed Wholesale. They take care of everything. Save time, gas, and membership fees with Boxed Wholesale. It's a big box club in your pocket. Go on your mobile device, visit Boxed.com, enter the promo code Adam at checkout for 15% off. Boxed.com.
Help Adam Carolla save podcasting for all of us. Donate anything you can at fundanything.com/patent troll.
All right, back with Dinesh D'Souza. Doing a special little one-on-one. Here's the Morgan Freeman clip.
So I thought what you said was fascinating because you called it bull when you said people can't, you know, pull themselves up. Do you think that race plays a part in wealth distribution or either a mindset that you can't
today?
Or cannot? Yeah.
No.
You don't?
No, I don't. I don't. You and I, we're proof. Why would race have anything to do with it? Put your mind to what you want to do and go for that. It's
all right.
Kind of like
that's what I like
mean,
about.
I'm startled by that. That's actually
I am too,
just
but
just the straightforwardness of it. And I don't know if he realizes, but if he went and said that on a campus, they would be like people fainting.
Well, he'd never get to speak on another campus. That'd be the end of the campus speaking. That's for goddamn sure. But what is the wealth distribution part? These are all new things to me. Like, what do you mean wealth? Who's distributing the money?
Exactly. As if there's some committee handing it out. You know, this is the weird thing. America, when this all started in the 1930s with FDR, it started with widows and orphans. There are people who can't look after themselves. And so we're a rich country. Why don't we make some allowance and figure out some ways to take care of them? I think that most of us agree on that. There's a consensus on that in our society. But this idea that if you're driving a Mercedes and I'm driving a Hyundai, that's inherently unjust. Why?
I don't know. And I think the plan, at least as I hear it, is I'm going to sell the Mercedes, you're going to sell the Hyundai, and we're both going to drive a Camry. That's the America that we want to live in. Here's the problem. The problem is, despite what is being force-fed to everybody about the silver spoon and the rich daddy and all that kind of stuff, 90% of the guys that are driving the Mercedes worked weekends, worked two jobs in college, got a higher degree, got specialized training, essentially busted their humps to get to that point in life where now they can drive the Mercedes. And if you stop them, if you take that Mercedes away from them or don't give them incentive to get the second Mercedes, we're going to be in bad shape.
The other thing is, if you peek into the Mercedes, you'll probably notice that the guy driving it is 60 years old. That same guy was driving a Hyundai when he was 25.
Well, that's, you know, what I say.
That's the American story.
Well, what I say to everybody when they talk about, I had this thought. I was thinking about, you know, they're always constantly talking about, oh, we got to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. We got to get to $15 an hour. And that's it. Well, that, what that does, and it's an interesting thing. There's rent control and there's raising the minimum wage. These are both left-leaning notions. That doesn't help anyone, because the day you tell a guy you'll get $15 an hour for turning a burger, and by the way, I found you an apartment in Santa Monica that's $1,000 off fair market value, guess who 40 years from now, when you're in your 60s, guess who's going to be living in an apartment, not a homeowner, guess who's going to be living in an apartment and working at McDonald's? You will, because we made it comfortable for you to do it. We made it feasible for you to do it. When I worked at McDonald's in 1979 and 1980, I got $2.42 an hour. I knew I had to get out of this job before high school. I was never going to be able to get my own apartment and pay rent and buy a pickup truck and do all those things at this wage. If you would have gave me the $15 an hour and gave me a rent control apartment, I'd probably still be at both places right now.
Yeah, you know, the reason capitalism works is it relies on information that the guy possesses who's on the spot. So if I were to ask you right now, in New York City, what's happening at Lexington and 43rd Street? You don't know. I don't know. Obama doesn't know. There aren't any bureaucrats in Washington who know. But the hot dog guy who works on that corner, he knows. The guy who's thinking of opening a store right there, he knows. The guy who lives right there, he knows. So the point is, capitalism works because people who are local make decisions about, well, looks like we could use another hot dog stand over here. Or it would be good to open a Starbucks right here because there isn't one in a 3-block radius or whatever. So when the central planners come in, they go, oh, we think that there were too many computers made last year. How the heck do they know? Obama goes, you know, I think there are too many people flying corporate jets.
Right.
He flies a corporate jet, by the way, which we pay for.
Yes.
At least the CEOs are paying for their own jets.
It's like I keep saying, what is the alternative? What is the plan? I mean, I talk to these politicians and I talked to Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, and he tells me he wants the check cashing places closed down. And I said, well, if the families that frequent the check cashing places would focus on family and education, then the places would close down by themselves. But you just want to close them down. That's not going to stop the problem. That's just going to mean there's a bunch of poor folks who don't have a place to cash their checks. What is your plan? His plan is no plan. His plan is hide behind his own rhetoric and say that that's what he believes.
Or to force the 7-Eleven in the inner city not to charge more than the 7-Eleven in the suburbs, even though its insurance costs are higher. It's dealing with all kinds of problems that you don't have if you're in the suburbs.
Right, but getting the folks at 7-Eleven to change their model is not a solution. And if it is, it's a falsely subsidized solution. The solution is let's focus on the family, the inner city, education, and see what we can do to fix that. And then the free market will take care of that 7-Eleven.
You know, what I never thought I'd see in my lifetime is that this great American formula of wealth creation that's made us the envy of the world is now being adopted in India and China, to a lesser degree in Brazil, and we're losing it at home. So it's our recipe, and
right.
other people are running with it right now.
I agree. There's a call that's been on the line for a while. Derek, 43, from Michigan.
Yeah, hi, guys. Dinesh, I've been a big fan of yours ever since you wrote that book about Ronald Reagan about, what, 10, 15 years ago. And Adam, I've been a fan of yours since The Man Show. And if you guys just had Dennis Miller sitting with you, I'd probably be the happiest guy in all of the,
yeah.
all the world.
Dennis would be miserable, but yeah.
Dinesh, actually, I heard you on Dennis Miller's show earlier this week, and I love your optimism, but I've got to side with him to a certain extent that I think there's a bunch of people like him that have just shrugged. And my question for you is, what is going to prevent us from being like Europe in 70 years? Because it seems that that's where we're at. We are literally 70 years behind where Europe was. We've got the Affordable Care Act now, which Europe had right after World War II. And I think it's just a matter of time before we end up with 6 weeks of mandatory vacation like Germany does, and you're going to see our kids rioting in the streets like the French were a couple of years ago because, heaven forbid, we cut the retirement age, or we raised the retirement age by 2 years. And it just seems to me that when you start giving people government programs like this, you can't put that genie back in the bottle. And I think it's just a matter of time before the rest of the country shrugs and we're going to be in even worse shape.
Thanks,
what's the
Derek.
Solution?
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. Dennis Miller, by the way, he just seems like he's just packing it in terms of his hope for this country. He's a smart guy. He's a funny guy, but his thing is like, look, I'm going to be dead in 20 years and you guys are on your own.
Well, if we keep going at this pace, I mean, look, Obama, in these 6 years, we have doubled the national debt. Now, that's kind of an arresting thought, right? Mm-hmm. We have $8.5 trillion, and in 6 years, this guy has taken it to $17 trillion. Now, you'd think that would be in the news, but I think we're in a very bizarre time when it's almost as if a lot of our journalist types, so-called, they don't want the first African-American to fail. And so they got to suppress the bad news, and we've got a courtier press, like at the French court, where the press basically is prancing around and lavishing praise on the aristocrats. I mean, it's embarrassing. So I can see where the pessimism is coming from. It's like information isn't getting out there. I mean, the reason I switched careers, I'm a think tank guy, I write books now, but I'm making movies because I find, 2016 was seen by 8 million people. My last book was number one in the New York Times bestseller list, 150,000 copies. So I think that when you give information to people, Americans are unbelievably commonsensical. They hear it, they're like, that makes sense. But the problem is Republican candidates have been inept. I mean, one thing you got to give Obama is he's determined and he's articulate and he fights for what he believes in. I think the counter to him is the disinfectant of truth. And this documentary is just trying to lift the curtain, first step toward doing that.
Stamps.com. Talk about a democracy. These guys want to save you time. Really the most precious thing you have. You don't have to go down to the post office. You go to Stamps.com. Stamps.com, we use them here. We never stop. My books, we send them out. You guys send in your book jackets. I sign them. We use stamps here. You buy and print official U.S. postage and just the amount that you need, whatever. Because I got a book. It's 320-something pages, the last one. It's hardcover. If I was sending it, I wouldn't know how many stamps to put on it, and I'd always put 5 extra stamps because I wouldn't want it coming back. Stamps.com has a great offer. It's got a scale. You plug it into your computer. You would weigh whatever you were sending. If you wanted to send me my book to sign, present me, thank you, you just put it on the scale. It prints out the correct amount of postage from your own printer. You put it on, and boom, done. And you get $55 free postage. So how can you lose? Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone, top of the homepage. Type in Adam. That is stamps.com, promo code Adam. And by the way, if you'd like your book jacket signed, send it in to me. Send it to our P.O. box. And we also got a deal on my last book. Because, Dinesh, I don't know if you do this, or how it works, but my publisher called me and said, yeah, we got 5,000 of your books, hardcover. Now we'll sell them to you for $3 a piece or they're going in the incinerator. And I said, fuck it, I'll take them. And I'll sell them to my fans and I'll just charge them basically the $3 plus postage. And that way you can have them and they won't be burned like this is Nazi Germany, circa 1939 and a half. Where the heck were we? We got a couple more phone calls for Dinesh. So you came here. Why did you come here at 17?
Well, I'd never been out of the country, and I was a fellow came to our school, and he was with the Rotary Club, and he said, we're doing this global exchange program, and we said, bring American kids to India, and would some of you guys want to go to America and study for a year? And I talked it over with my parents, and they thought that'd be really good for me. And boy, I came and I never left.
The Indian, at least the Eastern Indian culture, seems to have just been kicking ass in this country in the last few years. Or I didn't notice it 10 years ago, but I look around now and I'm like, they're winning every spelling bee. Every doctor I have is of that descent.
So,
they're just kicking ass. What is it, the parents? What's going on?
Well, India is so tough and so competitive. Get into a private school. I mean, the lines are around the block. I mean, there was an article a few years ago about you know, parents slapping each other because their kids failed the test to get into an elite school. And so the Indians develop kind of a Himalayan work ethic, you might say. Now, what they don't have is opportunity. And quite frankly, the Indian schools do not teach critical reasoning. But when the Indian kids come here, they have opportunity. They've got really good colleges, and so their work ethic, their rote memorization, you know, the putting in 6 hours a day on homework, all that stuff pays off big time because now it's you're basically dropping seed into very fertile ground.
What year is it that you come here?
Well, I came in 1978, and I was a freshman in college in 79.
And how much? So the thing I keep trying to tell everybody about discrimination is if you are a racist, you're a racist. Like, you don't like other cultures, it's sort of a Hitler thing. Like, he liked Aryan folks. He liked blue-eyed folks. He wasn't a fan of gypsies or Jews or blacks or retarded people. Like, he didn't like everybody. So the thing that I keep confounding me is I keep explaining to people, you don't get it. If the blue-eyed devil was really racist and really doing his job, he wouldn't just pick out a couple of races. He'd pick out the Jews would be included, and certainly Eastern Indian folk. I mean, I went to – when I was in junior high in North Hollywood, there wasn't a whole lot of Indian folk back in North Hollywood in the later 70s. There was one Indian kid. His name was Ayaz Sheikh, and he looked completely different than everybody else in that school. And we had, you know, one or two of everything in that school, but Ayaz looked really different. And we recognized he was different, but that's about where it ended. And I'm sure we had our jokes with him and mimicked his accent a little bit. And he didn't help himself by putting on a bunch of Brill cream. And, you know, while everyone else had, you know, everyone else looked like Leif Garrett, and all the chicks looked like Suzanne Summers or Farrah Fawcett. He had like the Brill cream with the 60s, you know, bad, you know, Mad Men comb over and everything. It was a little bit crazy. But the point is, as the white devil, we would have held him back like we would have held, like we're doing with every other group we're allegedly holding back, but yet we couldn't because...
Well, yeah, no, you know, when I came to this country.
Were you discriminated against? Were you bullied? What happened?
Never have I seen a topic, in this case racism, less experienced and more talked about. In other words, when I was in college, the talk of racism was everywhere. And the reality was no one could find it. In fact, even no matter who you talk to, you said, when is the last time it happened to you? Oh, it didn't happen to me, but it's everywhere. It's everywhere. So after a while, I realized what happened was the professor started talking about institutional racism, by which they meant racism so invisible that nobody knows where it is.
Right.
It's underground. It's covert. So what's really happened, I think, in our society is this racism thing – is often used as a shaming tactic.
Yes.
But the shaming tactic is in the full knowledge that the person being accused cannot possibly be a racist. And here's why. If somebody were to come to me and say, hey, you're an Indian, I would go, yes, I am. Thank you very much. But they say you're a racist because they want you to defend yourself. You're going to go, no, I'm not. I'm not a racist. The very fact that you're defending yourself shows that you have a moral code that's
right.
anti-racist. Otherwise, the charge wouldn't work.
Right.
The accusation only works if you're willing to acknowledge that racism is bad.
Right.
So our whole society is there now. Our whole society has no tolerance for racism. None.
Right.
And so we've come an awful long way. Look, I wouldn't want to be, you know, an immigrant coming, let's say, from Mexico or from India in 1910. I know enough history to know life would have been more difficult for me. But boy, this is a different America.
You talked about something that was interesting in your documentary about the Irish and the indentured servitude and coming over here in the thousands.
Yeah, we do some naughty, it's not naughty, it's really needed, hidden history, I call it, in the book, and I do more of it in the film, because what happens is the leftist narrative of shame relies on leaving a whole bunch of stuff out.
Sure.
And if they don't leave it out, the story doesn't work. So they've got to rig the facts. And so what we do is we go, okay, well, let's put in a few inconvenient facts that don't fit your narrative. You mentioned the Irish, indentured servitude. You know, there were 200,000 to 300,000 indentured servants brought to America. Much of the work that was done in early America was done by indentured servants.
Mm-hmm.
And indentured servants worked alongside slaves. Yes, their period was typically for 7 years, but most of them got into debt. Their terms were extended. Some of them died as indentured servants. So when you look at it, the actual treatment was not all that different. There wasn't the racial dehumanization. I do want to emphasize that because the indentured servants were white. But even then, people put up signs, no Irish need apply, and so on. So even there, the prejudice was alive and well.
I got another phone call for you and us. Andrew, 23, South Carolina.
Hey, Adam.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How about yourself?
Good. Say hi to Dinesh D'Souza.
Yeah, Dinesh, big fan of your movies. I saw 2016. I just want to get your opinion on the five terrorists that we traded for one kind of shady soldier there. Just kind of how it plays into how you say how America's kind of losing our standing in the world. It's the superpower.
What's your – you know what I'd like to know from someone as educated and thoughtful as you – is why would we and or Obama do that in the face of what is going to be a storm of bad publicity? It was flying under everyone's radar, and now it's on everyone's radar.
Yeah.
And it's not a good thing.
No.
Why would you do that? Now, I said it's a second term thing. I don't think you'd do it in the first term.
But I don't think they – look, I think this is a case where we have to make a big difference here. There's a difference between incompetence and which – now, incompetence is sort of defined by Jimmy Carter.
Right.
So let me give an example. Jimmy Carter yanked the Persian rug out from under the Shah, and whoops, he got Khomeini.
Right.
This is called, you know, being a nincompoop,
right?
It's called trying to get rid of the bad guy and you get the worst guy.
Right.
But see, Carter didn't know that. Carter was a fool. Obama's not a fool. Obama has an ideology, and his ideology is that we, the United States, in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then historically in Cuba and Guatemala and on, we're the bad guy. We're the imperialist power. We're the ones who are throwing our weight around the world. And if we're the bad guy, then the people fighting against us must be, from their point of view, freedom fighters. Just like if apartheid is bad, then Mandela, fighting against it, has got to be a freedom fighter.
Right.
So Obama looks at these Taliban guys. I'm not saying he likes them. I'm not saying he's a secret Muslim. No. But he looks at them as they're fighting American oppression. And Obama can understand that. So Obama looks at it. And that's why here's Obama chuckling and chortling and so on. He had no idea that the American people, even Democrats, would see this quite differently.
Well, what's in it for him, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Like, his worldview, the way he looks at it, just like in, you know, from the 1940s to the 1980s, the Soviet Union was the evil empire. We were trying to contain, which is to say, control them.
Mm-hmm.
I think Obama's view is that today, who needs to be controlled? Mm-hmm. We do. We're the world's sole superpower. You know, if you listen carefully to what he says, he always implies that we're the bully.
Right.
He doesn't even seem happy that we're the world's sole superpower. He once said something like this: like it or not, we're the world's sole super. Like it or not. It's almost like he'd rather we weren't, but since we are,
right.
You know. So this is a very strange guy we've put into the White House. Now, I don't think the American people knew that. This is why, unlike Dennis Miller, I'm not down on the American people. I think Obama kind of he kind of sold him a bill of goods. And because of the press, 6 years later, we're still sitting in the dark. But we're waking up.
Tell me what you think about this just from a psychological standpoint, because I was trying to think, you know, I was listening and watching you on Bill Maher's program and seeing real time and seeing you and Bill unite, which is interesting, on the topic of Islamic terror and fighting all the people that are, you know, all the Arianna Huffingtons that are constantly, you know, pushing back and saying not everyone and not all and you're saying and blah, blah, blah. I have a theory about this. I need to do a quick spot and then I want to ask you your opinion on it. E-voice, baby. Oh, you got a business? You got a small business? You didn't build that yourself. But let's say you'd like to continue building it with the help of eVoice. It's a better way. You can connect with your clients. You get your own toll-free number, professional greeting, dial by name directory, and more. You can transform any phone into your business phone. Customer calls are sent wherever you are, home, office, the beach, the bar, S&M dungeon, wherever you like. Doesn't matter. eVoice takes care of it right now. My listeners can try eVoice free. 30 days free. $5 off every month. And that's under $8 per month. So you can try eVoice free for 30 days and get the $5 discount. Again, under $8 a month. Let's not put this off. Hit pause right now. Go to eVoice.com. Set up your free trial. Enter the promo code Adam for additional $5 off per month. That's eVoice.com. Promo code Adam. So I grew up with some very progressive people. And I had the food stamps and the welfare. And it's always found it ironic that the people that were getting the most from the government, meaning my mom, food stamps and welfare, hated the government the most. It's not a coincidence. She's shamed. And it's like it's like when the dad says, look, you know, I'll pay for your car, but you gotta do some chores. You get angry at the dad instead of thinking, why can't I pay for my own car? Which is really the way you should be thinking. But either way, I grew up with a very progressive group of people. And my grandmother was even sort of communist for a while, way back in the day. And then my mom, I grew up on a steady diet of that, you know, well, the Soviets, they love their children too, and they're good people, and they're just people like we are, and our government in Reagan is, it's ginned up all this stuff. But, you know, if you went over there, you'd hear another side of the story and blah, blah, blah. And then I started thinking about someone like my grandmother, who was very for human rights and very for women's rights and very for minorities' rights and stuff that would not fly over there in the Soviet. You could put in a gulag if you were my grandmother. My grandmother, one of her best friends was a guy who was gay and he wore a dress and beads. He'd be locked up in right. in that environment,
put
somewhere in Siberia. So why are you such a big fan of this regime when it flies in the face of everything you talk about? And then I realized, you don't love communism. Nobody loves communism. Communism sucks. What you are is you're angry and you're rebelling against our system. It's not that you love the other system. It's one thing, you know, it's like me with the Patriots. I don't love the Baltimore Ravens. I just hate the Patriots, and I want to see the Ravens win whenever they play the Patriots.
Right.
So ironically, using the Patriots as an example, I don't think my grandmother loves communism. I don't think my mother loved the Soviet Union. She's angry at our country. And the people that are constantly talking about, you know, the Islamic world and pushing back on guys like you and Bill Maher and guys like that, saying that are they big fans of that religion, of that government, of that way of life? Are they big fans of that? Or are they just sort of angry and mad at us?
Right. I think you put your finger on it completely. In other words, what they're doing is they're projecting their dissatisfaction and even hatred of their own small town or their pastor or their what they see as the provincialism of American life, and they are fantasizing something about Islam that is not. So, but what to me is amazing is that when the Muslims try to clearly say we're not, okay, here's an honor killing to prove that we're not what you think we are, the left sort of averts its gaze and they go, well, it can't be that, or that's not typical, or that's not coming from Islam. It's some sort of aberration. These people aren't true Muslims, and so on. Well, I mean, I think it's really funny when you got people like Obama telling the Muslims who are the true Muslims.
It's insane that women's rights and gay rights and minority rights or religious freedom and stuff is all the stuff. They never stop ringing that bell on the left. And then here's a group that is not down with any of that stuff. And right. You've decided, Arianna Huffington, to defend them vehemently.
The Muslims today, the radical Muslims, are the most illiberal force in the world. And ironically, in America, they have the protection of the liberals.
And they've turned on Israel, which is insane to me. I mean, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm not Jewish. I'm not religious. I'm not anything. But it just, as a guy who's standing on the outside, just sort of looking in, I'm thinking, is Israel the problem in that territory?
Right. Here's this little oasis in this big desert, you know, and these guys are productive. They've got a successful economy. They're a democracy. And there's plenty of room outside of Israel, and yet everybody's on Israel. I think it's because, to be honest, I think Israel is taking our heat. Israel is seen as the little Satan that's the extension of the great Satan, which is the United States.
I had from Dinesh's documentary, America, Imagine a World Without Her, there was another clip that I wanted to play that I thought was very interesting. And it's so funny because Dr. Drew would sit around and talk about, is it Alexis de Tocqueville? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Yep.
And he'd always quote him. And me, I have no formal education, so I'd never had any idea who he was talking about. But he was sort of a Frenchman who wandered the United States around
the 1820s.
About the 1820s.
Or maybe early 30s.
And just sort of like a guy from a completely different culture, and it was just sort of wandered around and made notes and observed.
Well, what was cool about Tocqueville was he came 50 years after the American founding. So the founding principles were in action, if you will. And he was an outsider. So he knew, I mean, Americans, you know, we take it for granted here. But when an immigrant like me comes or a foreigner like Tocqueville comes, they notice what's strange about America. So they actually are very insightful in telling us what's special, good or bad, about ourselves.
Well, there's an interesting little clip as it pertains to slavery, and I found it to be something that I just never thought about before. I'll play the clip.
Now, Tocqueville did recognize the things that Zinn talks about. At one point, Tocqueville stood on the Ohio-Kentucky border. He looked north, and he saw industrious Ohio. He looked south, and he saw idle Kentucky. On both sides, he commented, the soil is equally fertile, the situation just as favorable. So what explained the difference? Slavery, Tocqueville said, degrades work. It produces a people without energy, without a spirit of enterprise.
That part I understood. That made sense to me. It's the second part that I never really thought about.
Slaves have no incentive to work because they don't get to keep the fruit of their labor.
That I understood. It's this part.
And masters become lazy because there are slaves to do everything for them.
That's the part I didn't really think about.
Right. And that's the, you know, that's the way that the Southern economy became, if you will, a backward economy.
Yeah, you're making everybody lazy. You got one group that doesn't want to be there and is not getting, you know, getting to wet their beak, so to speak. So yep. they're not motivated. And then you got a guy who's not really doing, he's getting his work for free. So he's not really motivated.
Exactly. I remember there's a funny story of Frederick Douglass when he was a slave. He said that he routinely would steal from his masters. There was a big tub of food. And he goes, but I didn't see it as stealing. He goes, because the master owned the tub and the master owned me. So I'm merely transferring the master's goods from one spot to the other.
Really, again, for all the people like myself who have just had an impacted assful of this country being beat up upon, and again, that doesn't mean that we don't look back and acknowledge our mistakes, and that we don't, that there's not need for some regulation, and that Wall Street can't get out of control, and that there needs to be, It's not a black and white issue. It's just an issue that I feel like we have been kicking our own ass relentlessly over the last, 8 or 10 years in this country, and we seem to step it up every year. And I'm tired of being a citizen of a country that's inherently good and trying to turn us into a bad people in a bad place, and subscribing to a way of life, which is take care of the family, educate the kids, pay your taxes, work hard, create jobs, and turning those guys into the troublemakers. I'm just tired of it. And this is a documentary that is sweet relief for those who have had an impacted ass full of that over the last 8 to 10 years.
Well, we're releasing it at the 4th of July because we want people to say, hey, it's the 4th of July. Let's unkick our own butts, if you will. Let's go discover what's good about America. It was Gene Kirkpatrick who once said, we got to face the truth about ourselves no matter how pleasant it is. There's some good things about this country.
Well, it's nice and you know, it's nice that it comes from a guy with brown eyes and brown skin who comes from a foreign land who came here and said, I'm here for these opportunities. And now, you know, obviously when a guy like Mitt Romney tries to talk this way, he's immediately stoned to death by everyone who says, well, okay, with the rich daddy and the blue eyes.
Well,
shut up.
The other difference is that Romney is maybe more of a gentleman than I am. He runs from the fight, whereas I run toward the fight. In other words, I want to take on these guys because I realize their game. Their shaming of America is a prelude to the shakedown of America.
Right.
And so they're playing they've got a political racket going, which they're presenting to our young people as just history. So I'm determined to blow the whistle on them, and I think this film's going to help do that.
Well, also, I see you debating these guys, and as I always say to my wife when she says, how come you win every argument? I always go, I don't argue unless I'm right. And thus, my batting average goes way up. It's easy to win these debates because, look, you get Diane Warren and you try to debate with her. You have all the statistics in your corner. She's just talking. She's just blathering on about heart. It's all coming from her heart. And I don't even think it's her heart. I just think it's her speaking in sound bites.
You know, and I think it's I also think it's the ocean of envy and resentment.
Wait, did I say Dan Warren again?
Elizabeth Warren.
Now I'm officially screwed. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was saying that I think very often we just think these people are, you know, they're smart people who make mistakes. You have to realize that the intellectual class is motivated by envy. They don't like to live in an entrepreneurial society. Many of them think, what the heck does Steve Jobs know that I don't? Why is he worth billions of dollars? Now, I'm making $130,000 and I drive a BMW, but still, why are the entrepreneurs the sort of heroes of the society? Envy is a very powerful force in any society.
Yes.
And in our society, it's the envy against the entrepreneur.
Well, and by the way, give me Elizabeth Warren's, and Dinesh, you probably know more about her background, but she, first off, the thing that I found interesting about her is she did work her way up. And then she was an attorney, I think, and made quite a bit of money.
Well, and then she suddenly discovered or claimed to be a Cherokee. I don't know if you heard that.
Yes, I remember that.
So she's playing the shame game all the way up and down.
She, but I think she was an attorney that did a bunch of class action lawsuits as well. But it's always funny when you go like, you know, I'm Cherokee, I'm a female, I'm oppressed, but I have a faculty gig over at Harvard Law. Well, which is it? Why? Right. You know, now I believe, I don't know if you've thought about it, but I think it's a form of grandiosity to go, look how much better I am that I have overcome all of these obstacles and hurdles. It's a way to pat yourself on the back without really patting yourself, without looking like you're grandiose, but you're essentially saying, I'm this, I'm that. It's basically me. It's me saying, I was a cruiserweight champion of the world, and I don't have the use of my right arm. Imagine if I had the use. It's basically quietly saying, imagine if she was a male. Imagine if she wasn't 156 Cherokee. Imagine what she would be doing with that in her hip pocket.
Right. It's a false humility, is what you're saying. Right. It's actually a form of conceit masquerading as humility.
It is, because think about what you're saying. I mean, if you're saying, I won the race, and I did it on a bad ankle. Now, it's not only if you won the race, but you did it on a bad ankle. The, I'm a female, minority, I'm a whatever, is the, and I won it on a bad ankle.
Right, right, exactly.
Let's see. She, what did she do professionally before she got into academia?
It appears that she got into academia and started focusing on bankruptcy law and got kind of a focus in that and then shifted around to a bunch of different colleges as a professor after her education.
But she never worked at a law firm? You can look for it. I'll talk about technology here. Dinesh, here's something you would like. iGrill. Yeah. You don't want to be that last guy hanging out at the grill. I know you do a lot of barbecuing over there in India. We may even do more here in the United States. Yeah. Watching football, drinking, you got to hang out at the grill. You got to keep checking the meat. Not with iGrill. iGrill too. Love these guys. Now, what it is, it's a Bluetooth grilling thermometer. You set it on, not on the grill, but on the side of the grill. You plug it in, and then your smartphone contacts you when the meat's done, when it gets up to a certain temperature, whatever you set it to, whatever you can monitor your meat from your phone 150 feet away. So you get to head back into the house and watch a ball game and tilt a couple of cold ones with the guys while the stuff's in the grill, while it's in the smoker, whatever it is. You have to keep going out and checking the status and checking the temperature and all that. The app has a ton of preset temperature alarms. So a little alarm will go off and go, hey, it's time to flip the steak over, and it's based on how you want your meat cooked. I mean, this is really why the terrorists hate us, right? This right here.
Well, and this is why Elizabeth Warren hates, because she'd never think of that one. I mean,
no.
She'd rather read about her own Cherokee history than come up with the iGrill.
It's a brand new product. It just hit the market last week. It's $99.99, and you get free shipping in the U.S., and you go to iGrillInc.com. That's iGrillInc.com. All right. One more question, then we'll bring it home. Let's see. Let's talk to Matt, 24, San Jose. Matt?
How's it going, Adam?
Good.
Good. I was wondering, I mean, you talk about politics a lot compared to the other top podcast, other top comedian or comedy podcast. I was wondering if you've ever encountered a situation where someone wanted to go on your podcast because they liked you, but they didn't want to be associated with what your image is.
Well, it probably has happened, but I'll never know about it. I'll just hear from the publicist that so-and-so passed, or I won't. I mean, you don't know. Again, it's like bad breath. It just happens. I don't know if people tell you about it. Maybe you're scared
people
to ask.
People told me about bad breath.
Oh, good. I don't know. It's a thing that's bothering me a lot because I never thought of myself as political. I certainly never thought of myself as conservative. I'm just a guy who said, look, you want to have kids? Fine, have kids. You pay for them. I'll pay for my kids. You have kids? Fine. You feed your kids. I'll feed my kids. And then when you say to me, yeah, but there's a lot of poor folk who don't have enough to give their kids breakfast. I think, have enough? That's 50 cents. You get some oats, put them in the microwave, put a little tap water in there and some brown sugar. They're good.
This is what happened to me. I came to America from India. I'd never thought about politics. My dad's a chemical engineer. And it was only in college that when people began to tell me that, well, this is what a conservative believes. A conservative believes that there are bad people in the world and no amount of conversation is going to stop them from being bad. I'm like, well, that sounds right to me. That you need to work hard for what you got and that, you know, you need a free market system because it allows the guy at the bottom to climb up the ladder. We want to have a free society, but we want to have a decent society. You want to have some, you know, law and order, and you want to basically have the pursuit of happiness, as Jefferson called it. Our foreign policy, even though people say America's evil, our foreign policy is basically A, don't bomb us, and B, trade with us.
Right.
And that's it.
Yes.
Can a more benign foreign policy be imagined?
I don't get it. I do feel like there are many more people who share our sensibilities, but the few people who disagree with us have bullhorns.
They have big bullhorns, and they're intimidators. They go around, you know, one reason Hollywood is so homogenous is that if you get off the reservation, they slap you around a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I know. I feel it every day. But the good news is, unlike what Elizabeth Warren would have you believe, I built my own pirate ship. I have my own studio. I have my own warehouse.
You mean you didn't have a school teacher somewhere? You didn't take the public roads?
Actually, I had some of the shittiest teachers. My counselor, Mr. Tomey, didn't do shit for me. My school teachers were mostly horrific. I didn't learn anything. And no, I don't owe my school teachers or my counselors anything. They did a piss poor job with me. I was uneducated. I cleaned up garbage on a construction site. And my counselor was just there to, you know, I got suspended once and I had to go sit in his office. That was it. I was never counseled on anything. So no. And by the way, the roads here are covered with potholes. So no, the roads aren't fantastic. Last time I called the fire department was never. Last time my wife called the cops, they wouldn't show up to the house. A drunk driver hit the wall outside of my house. I was on the road, surprise, surprise, on the weekend, paying more into the system via taxes. And my wife called the cops and they said, go check it out yourself because we don't have enough to come out. So no, this was built. It was built by me and you people support it and God bless you for it. And that's an atheist talking. We're going to be in Phoenix at Stand Up Live. You can come out and say hi to everybody. We're going to be doing live podcasts. That's June 20th and the 21st. Four shows. Long Beach, first show sold out. Second show added. So you can come on out. And Treasure Island, Las Vegas, and Phoenix on the 21st. I'm going to be Total Wine at noon. Selling a little Mangria. And speaking of Mangria, it's all available now, the white and the red and the rosé, and that's a good Father's Day gift. So let's not forget about that, my friends. All right. Dinesh D'Souza, thank you so much for coming in. America, Imagine a World Without Her. The book is out as we speak, and that you go through Amazon and get that. You know what to do. And then the doc is hitting theaters the 2nd.
July 2nd.
July 2nd. Dinesh D'Souza, thank you so much for
my
coming
pleasure.
In. Come back anytime. Until next time, it's Adam Kroll for Dinesh D'Souza saying mahalo.
For call-in times and phone topics, follow the show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Get the new book, President Me, audiobook available as well. And use the Amazon link at adamcarolla.com. Tickets and info on all the live podcasts, stand-up, Mangria events, and more. It's adamcarolla.com. Corolla Digital.